Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Doctor's Kitchen. Recipes, health, lifestyle.
There was a famous thing called slip, slap, slop in Australia to get people to slip on a hat, slop on the sun cream. And I said, nobody mentioned food or smoking. You know, if you smoke in the sun, you've got two lots of carcinogen damaging your sun. And it's been shown over and over again that that increases skin damage. On the other hand, if you drink a glass of red wine, eat some hummus and some olives, those counterbalance the direct damage from the sun.
Welcome to the Doctor's Kitchen podcast. The show about food, lifestyle, medicine, and how to improve your health today. I'm Dr. Rupi, your host. I'm a medical doctor, I study nutrition, and I'm a firm believer in the power of food and lifestyle as medicine. Join me and my expert guests where we discuss the multiple determinants of what allows you to lead your best life. I am so excited about today's podcast episode. Professor Robert is on the pod talking about his incredible new book, How to Live. I've recommended his previous books that have focused on the topic of cancer, such as Keep Healthy After Cancer. But this new book appears to cover every FAQ I've come across throughout the years of lecturing, speaking, and demoing across the country and internationally. I highly, highly recommend this book with over 500 references in the back, but explained in plain language in the text. Prof has really created a book that is super engaging and cuts through the noise, but it also tackles some of the most controversial topics in an open-minded manner, which I think is incredibly useful in today's misinformation environment. On today's pod, you will learn about toxins in food, chemicals in household products and whether to be worried about those, hormone disruption and what toxic load refers to, milk and cancer, xenoestrogens, which are synthetic estrogens, what they actually mean and how to avoid them, EMF and whether there's evidence of harm, that's electromagnetic frequency, the beauty and utility of colorful food, why the gut is central to health and well-being, and tips and actions for you to take today to live better. As a reminder, Professor Robert Thomas is a consultant oncologist at Bedford and Addenbrooke's hospitals, a clinical teacher at Cambridge University, and visiting professor of sports and nutritional science at the University of Bedfordshire. He is life's lead of a lifestyle and cancer research unit, and he is also a medical advisor to the website cancernet.co.uk. This is a brilliant podcast episode. I really hope you enjoy it, and onto the pod. Okay, I want to talk about your book. First of all, how on earth did you find the time to write this book? Because it is, if I could describe it in a word, it's comprehensive. You know, you've got over 500 references in this. And as I know, this is going to be the skimmed down version of the book. You must have written, you know, upwards of twice the amount of content to get it down into here. What was that experience like?
Well, as you know, you've written several books. It's satisfying because when you search for information and when you give a talk or write a paper, you know, you really have to understand the subject quite well. So it's a good way of educating yourself in the writing process. I mean, fortunately, I've been doing lifestyle related research for over 20 years and written a fair amount of papers, up to 100 papers on different subjects, whether that's exercise, polyphenols, gut health, sugar. You know, I was getting so much criticisms from people saying you shouldn't stop people eating sugar, that obviously the only way to defend yourself is to write an evidence review so you can have an intelligent argument. So all that data was essentially there. We added some, and we had contributions from various people, like someone from the Royal Horticultural Society looking at the benefits of plants, etc. So I did get some great help from people. But it's the process of changing a medical paper into a book which is aimed at the general public is the challenge. And I wouldn't say I'm naturally gifted in writing, so that took a lot longer. But of course, it is through a publisher, so they do cover your back and rewrite chapters of sort of scientific blah blah and convert it into lay language. So I was very grateful for that, and that's why I think it, compared to my previous books, it's much more readable.
Yeah, because your previous books, I always recommend to friends and colleagues, and unfortunately, I've had a number of people, as you know, that unfortunately have been diagnosed with cancer, and they look straight away to me and other people, you know, to offer some advice. And I always recommend your other books because they are brilliant, and they, like you said, they're a bit more medically focused. They don't shy away from the science, which I think a lot of people appreciate. But this is almost like, you know, an FAQ section of the commonest questions that I get asked about, covering everything from the environment. And you don't shy away from subjects here. You talk about the environment, you talk about toxins, you talk about fats and cholesterol and all these different elements that I'm sure you get asked about pretty much daily in clinic.
Well, what I get, patients like, they want to help themselves. The vast majority of patients. So, you know, the days of paternalism have gone. You know, if you had time, they would love to have a conversation of what they can do when they leave clinic. And the more I think people understand that these things do actually work, they're more likely to change. Where people get confused is one doctor's telling them not to exercise or eat as much sugar as you want, and another doctor's telling them another thing, and they feel, you know, demotivated. But if they get a clear message which they believe in, they're more likely to change. And, you know, I am getting patients from around the country saying, you know, they've gone to their doctors and the doctors said, oh, no, there's nothing you can do. It's just a genetic disease. And that could be talking about, you know, cholesterol, blood pressure, cancer, joint pains, anything. But they're told there's nothing they can do. It's a genetic disease. You just have to take the medication. And people are pushing back and saying, no, you know, I'm not going to go on to that statin. I mean, I saw a guy yesterday who had a cholesterol of 6.8 and declined statins, and he followed the guidelines. Okay, it took him 18 months, but he's got a cholesterol of 4.1 now and feels great. I know, you know, he's a particularly motivated individual, yeah. But nobody would say, oh, you're putting that man at risk with that advice because he's now not on a statin. It's better that he's not on a statin and has a low cholesterol. You know, the same applies for cancer. We know that, you know, there are a lot of very unfortunate young people or any people get cancer and it comes back and it's dreadful. But the evidence is there that if you change your lifestyle, you do have a reduced risk of the cancer coming back. You have reduced risk of the serious chronic diseases you get after cancer treatment. So it's all about reducing your odds. And, you know, I believe most people want to hear those odds. They want to know what to do.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's that, you know, that delicate combination of compassion and empathy for one's situation with the tools and the information. And I think the way you've presented it as well is very accessible, and it just gives people the impetus and the motivation to make changes. Because, you know, like you said, that sort of traditional paternalism that has been inbuilt in the medical education system, particularly perhaps when you were at medical school as well, you know, that is slowly dying off, and it should do, because we need to have a bit more of a compatible relationship with people.
Yeah, no, it's and you know, it is changing, but I think it's changing too slowly. And it is frustrating, you know. You've got a busy practice. Someone comes in, blood pressure a bit raised. You have a chat, you know. They come back a month later. I mean, GPs don't rush into giving drugs. I have to say, I'm not criticising, but you know, they're limited time, and a lot of people don't change. But I found with persistence and with knowledge, they can. I mean, for example, I took a non-steroidal, this is about 20 years ago, before a marathon. The worst thing you can do, by the way, because you get dehydrated and it concentrates. And I had high blood pressure for a year. And there's no way I was going to go on antihypertensives. I knew what I'd done wrong. And I just, you know, took celery and beetroot smoothies and cut down my salt. And now my blood pressure, you know, a year later, blood pressure is 119 over 65, you know. So I know that's a case of one. But, you know, and I hear stories from lots of other motivated people. And it's such a shame when you get a patient coming up to you and going, I said, what medication are you on? And they say, just the usual, doc. You know, the usual, as you know, is, you know, anti-indigestion, anti-blood pressure, laxatives, statins, anti-diabetic, costing themselves a lot of trauma and side effects, but also the country billions of pounds a year in medication which could be avoided.
Yeah, you know what? I literally had a patient like that on Sunday night who came into A&E, and he came for an unrelated issue, and I asked him about his medication list. And I think it's because they've been on these meds for so long that it's just become habitual and become normalized. And he was like, bit of blood pressure, bit of diabetes, bit of gourd, you know, a little bit of your stomach. That, and you look at the list and you're like, oh my God, there's just so many on here. I mean, I know he came in for a completely different reason. But I think this time, particularly in a post-pandemic era, it marks a moment where it could almost be like our Anya and Bevan moment, where we actually create something within our culture that encourages people to, yes, with compassion, take control of our lifestyles and our health such that we reduce the burden on the NHS, and we actually give people the power and the tools to do so by changing our food landscape and getting a government in that actually encourages that as well. It makes a real, real effort to do so.
Yeah, no, I think that's, I always present, apart from being on your show, which is, you know, the highlight of my year, I have to say, you know, I've stopped being invited by drug companies to conferences because all I do is tell people not to take drugs. So, you know, I'm not getting any fans from the drug industry. But, you know, I always show in my talks a guy who came to me with prostate cancer. It's just low-grade prostate cancer. And he was suitable for active surveillance. So, you know, we can just watch, see how he goes. But he was on the usual, you know, he had 10 different medications. So I had the fortune of meeting him every 3 or 4 months for the first 2 years. And every time he came, he managed to stop one of his medications. And 18 months later, we managed to get him off everything. And it was so rewarding. And at the same time, his PSA and his prostate cancer got better. So most of the conversation wasn't about his prostate cancer. It was about, you know, indigestion, do these other things. And he was really grateful. So, you know, sometimes... you know, having a disease which gets you into the medical profession or seeing a doctor like yourself gives you the opportunity to sort of work on the whole picture, not just one of the issues. Because they're all related at the end of the day, aren't they? You know, it's all chronic
absolutely.
Disease.
Yeah, yeah. You talk about the relationship actually between a whole bunch of different lifestyle related illnesses in the book as well. And I think, you know, it's the challenge is scaling up that scenario that you've just described right there. And I think it comes down to, yes, a lot more medics talking about this as we are at the moment on this pod, but also giving people the tools and incentivizing it and, you know, even subsidizing things like fruits and vegetables or cook-alongs or, you know, these different lateral thinking movements that we can't do at an individual level. We have to rely on a government level.
Yeah, and some doctors are worried about the medical legal issues, that if you stop a statin and they get a heart attack, they'll be sued. And I think that there needs to be a built-in protection from that. So I've only had two complaints in the last 10 years, and one was an end-stage bladder cancer. And I did say, look, there's no point in having chemo. It's very toxic. It's unlikely to help you. And I tried to talk about lifestyle. And they actually sort of made a complaint. They say all the doctor was talking about was getting me to eat better. Fortunately, that was upheld by the ombudsman, and that was encouraging. But still, many doctors are sort of worried about stopping treatment and if they then go on to develop an ease. But that should be... you know, I don't think they need to be, but that should be emphasized in training. That, you know, it's you're not going to get sued if you don't start a statin or a blood pressure pill. It's perfectly appropriate to give the lifestyle. And lifestyle should be seen as a, you know, an integrative part of the management and are just as important or even more important. And I love your comment about the, you know, most of the lifestyle things we do prevent a disease which might be 10 years away. So, you know, we all think, oh, well, I'll do it tomorrow, you know. But with COVID, it's likely, and this is my strong belief, that if you change your lifestyle now, you might reduce the risk of an infection tomorrow. So it might give that extra incentive for people to say, well, now, you know, now we're in lockdown, now we're not doing much else, maybe concentrate more on my health. I hope so anyway.
I really hope so, yeah. No, I echo that belief. And I think you hit on a really important point there about the culture within medicine and the fear of being you know, taken to the GMC or strung in front of people for giving lifestyle advice when the patient themselves demanded a pill or, you know, a proper quote-unquote intervention. And that is echoed by a lot of my colleagues who are not privy to nutritional medicine, lifestyle medicine, and all the other adjuncts that we have to traditional therapies. Let's talk about dietary toxins. I know I don't want to start because your book is very positive and I love the title, How to Live. But you do start talking about dietary toxins, which I stay clear of because a lot of people might think, you know, I'm scaremongering, whatever. But I think it really does warrant a conversation because a lot of people are not aware of where they lurk in food and what things we need to actually be a bit more vocal about when it comes to telling people what to avoid.
So as you say, the advice in the book could really be split up into, you know, what to do more of and what to do less of. And dietary toxins could be carcinogens or pro-inflammatory chemicals or even things like processed sugar. Just coming back to your point about the title, you'd be surprised how many meetings we had about the title. I mean,
really?
I'm sure you know this with your 1-2-3 cook, which I love. Yeah. I think it's called 1-2-3 cook or something.
3-2-1.
Oh, that's the one, sorry. You know, it wasn't meant to be, you know, me sort of telling everyone how to live. You know, it was a bit of play on words. There's another popular book called How Not to Die. Mm-hmm. And I thought, well, it's not just about how not to dying. It's how to live, you know, without being on multiple medications, how to live without having a chronic disease, how to live with less fatigue, more ability to exercise. So that's what it's meant to be. It's not meant to be, you know, a guidebook for life, but anyway, that's a side issue. So I hope people see that. So in avoiding toxins, you know, it's quite fascinating. If you look on the WHO website or National Institute of Health website, you know, carcinogens are really major etiology of cancer, but other diseases like dementia, arthritis. And they're sort of, although we talk about them, I'm not sure how many people take them seriously. And they can stem from, you know, how the food is grown, you know, with pesticides, herbicides. So going on to organic will reduce that, although on a global perspective, I'm not sure how practical that is or whether it's needed. Don't forget, it's the cooking process. You know, if you get meat and burn it on a griddle, as you know, the fat is converted into carcinogens. If you get sugary foods or processed carbohydrate, then heat them to high temperatures in the oven, you get acrylamides, which are carcinogenic. So it's not just about the food themselves, it's how it's cooked. And then finally, it's how what you eat them with. I love a study from Maryland, which was a barbecue where they got half the sort of meals, which was the standard, you know, you shove a bit of meat onto a barbecue, you fry it to smithereens, it's completely black, you eat it on its own or maybe with some crisps and some sugary drink. And they measured you can measure blood, a blood test, which looks at the number of sort of potential mutations which have developed. And also the number of carcinogens. And that was almost five times higher than people who'd had a similar amount of meat, but they'd cooked it more slowly, they hadn't burnt it, they'd marinated it with herbs and spices, or in that trial, particularly rosemary, and they'd eaten it with a salad. So, you know, it's about how you eat it, what you combine things with. So we're not telling to people, you can't eat this thing, you can't go for a barbecue, but just combine it with healthy things, which are the natural antidotes. And then the other category, of course, are things you've put in cosmetics. And, you know, we can't do a lot about air pollution, perhaps, unless you move away from a main road. But you can choose to jog in a park rather than alongside of a road. You can reduce the amount of chemicals we use in the house, keep the windows open, have more house plants. So on a daily basis, there is quite a lot you can do to reduce your toxin exposure.
Yeah, this whole concept of toxin load is something I think I'm learning a bit more about myself, because I don't use many beauty products. I might use a face wash and a moisturizer, but that's about it. But how much do you think we need to be wary of what we put on our skin, what we wash ourselves with, and the other products that we use in our household? I mean, it's probably become even more important considering the last year where we spent most of the time in our houses.
Yeah, yeah, there's a lot of time. There's some very good data on this, and I think I quote one in the study where if you looked at, say, a shampoo or something which has got some parabens or a deodorant's got a bit of aluminium, and you look at that on its own and you say, look, you know, they're very tiny amounts of chemicals, and the data, there's no significant link. And it's true, you know, if you just use that item with nothing else, the risk would be infinitesimally small. However, we don't, do we? We have a shower gel, we then you know, maybe have a shampoo, maybe a deodorant. And there's a very good paper looking at the, as you just said, the toxic load throughout the day. And you combine that with maybe some phytoestrogens in your or xenoestrogens in your food, some aluminium or maybe parabens. And that total load has been investigated, and it's the total load which matters. And that's not published on the back of individual products. They don't often compare their product in combination with 10 others which are similar. Mm. And that's why they get by, you know, that's why they don't get banned. But I always say to people, look, if you want to reduce, you know, I actually make my own cream. You know, I don't buy commercial creams. Hence, I've not been sponsored by L'Oreal to give a talk, obviously. So I just get, you know, extra virgin olive oil and some essential oils and some unprocessed. There's like shea butter you can get, which has not been industrially processed, and just mix it up with some emulsifiers, and that's what we use. I use it on my kids who've got a bit of eczema, because it's got no polyphenols and no preservatives, no scent apart from what's in the essential oils. But of course, they're very difficult to make commercially because they go off. You know, they get fungus on top of them within 4 weeks. So you know, I think it's important. You know, and that's what I emphasise in the book. You know, try to limit the amount. If you have if you take deodorants, just use them on days which really matter. You know, if you've got your first date or an important business meeting, but don't just slap them on every day. You know, because it's the amount of you're taking every day of your life, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I'm really glad we're having this conversation. As a side note, I know you say that you can't cook, but if you were to do another book, it sounds like you could do a beauty book with creams and potions and everything else.
Yeah, I think, you know, it is a bugbear that you go to a dermatologist and instantly you get, you know, steroid cream, and you look at the bases in the cream and it's all hydrocarbons, scents, preservative, pesticide. Nobody seems to talk about that. Mm. You know, I think there are other people interested in this, but I think this is where commercialism isn't good. You know, if everyone's worried about the price, and these big companies have to make hundreds of thousands of a product, and it has to last for 3 or 4 years in order for them to make any money, which is they need to. But you know, I think there's a role for the smaller, more bespoke companies who can make sort of fresh products without these chemicals added.
Yeah, it's almost like there's a local beauty industry that's waiting to revolutionize currently how we buy beauty products. Because like you said, you know, if you were to just mix all those products into a little pot and then put it on the shelf, it would go off, which is why you need those preservatives to make it shelf stable and drive the price down. But these products would be pretty fantastically expensive otherwise.
Yeah, well, it depends. You know, if we're more used to buying locally and buying off small wholesalers, so you know, I think it is possible. Yeah.
Mm, mm. This is probably going to be a difficult question to answer, but do you think, obviously, in combination with the other effects of sedentary lifestyle, low vitamin D, poor diets, would that toxic load have an impact on lifestyle-related illnesses that we're seeing today?
Yes, I mean, I think with the exception of dementia, which is mm-hmm. sort of going up, as you know, it's a very rapidly increasing disease. Not just because people are getting older. You know, I think if you've got toxins, I think they can directly affect the brain, even if you're healthy in other ways. Mm-hmm. But for other diseases such as diabetes, heart disease, pancreatitis, I think there is clearly a balance. You know, you can get away with it. It's a bit like the barbecue story. You can get away with it. I mean, I probably drink a couple of glasses too many on a Friday evening. You know, I have tried to convince myself it's just the resveratrol, but you know, there are lots of negatives in alcohol. Alcohol itself is a toxin, you know, let's not fool ourselves. But you know, it's a balance. If you eat that with, you know, if you have a good meal with it, you know, and then you go for a run the next day, it's all about the balance, you know, and getting the balance right, rather than putting people in a, you know, in a sort of on a pedestal and criticizing every move they take. And I believe yeah. balance is it. And you know, the same with sunbathing. There was a famous thing called slip, slap, slop in Australia to get people to slip on a hat, slop on the sun cream. And I said, nobody mentioned food and or smoking. You know, if you smoke in the sun, you've got two lots of carcinogen damaging your sun. And it's been shown over and over again that increases skin damage. On the other hand, if you drink a glass of red wine, eat some hummus and some olives, those counterbalance the direct damage from the sun. In fact, I saw a paper the other day saying something like dietary sunscreens, they're called. So, you know, if you're going to go in the sun, which we all enjoy, and it's good for you to a certain extent, you know, make sure you have fruit and vegetables and herbs and spices that day.
Yeah, I think I came across the same paper. It was like the equivalent of two cups of grapes or something like that in combination, and it improved the, what's the word they use, photoprotective yeah. effects in combination with skin block as well. So that's super interesting. And I agree with you, we should also be talking about diet when it comes to skin too. Well, let's talk about the foods that we should be embracing, and specifically those plant nitrates that we were talking about earlier and what effect those might have versus the nitrites that you find in processed food.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I mean, everyone gets super confused about nitrates, nitrites, nitrous oxide, nitric oxide. I mean, I was interviewed about, well, there was a paper coming out about processed meats. And the journalist said, but you're saying that nitrates are bad for you, but then nitrates are in plants. And yes, they are. And I was trying to explain that. When you have a nitrate in meat, you're having it with protein, and that's then converted into nitrous amines in the stomach, which is actually the carcinogen. Mm. But if you have nitrates in plants, the polyphenols and the vitamin C in the plant converts that nitrates into nitric oxide, which actually is beneficial. It causes dilation of the blood pressure, brings your blood pressure down, gives oxygenates your tissues. So it's again the combination. And obviously, when you have it in meat, you've got other bad things in the meat, like aromatic hydrocarbons. And if you've burnt it, you've got smoke. Or if it's smoked, you've got smoke directly. So yeah, nitrates aren't bad. It per se. And you've just mentioned, you know, celery, beetroot, pomegranate. Those are particularly rich in nitrate, healthy nitrates. So if you've got blood pressure problems, or if you want to improve your sports performance, those are the foods you should be taking.
Yeah. I'm glad we clarified that difference, because it's something I get asked about a lot as well. And the way you've explained it is bang on. There's a lot of talk around lectins, phytic acid, and why they might be bad for you. I probably get a couple of messages 2-3 times a month, actually, about why am I using beans and lentils when aren't they meant to be anti-nutrients and removing thing minerals from your body and how it's bad for you. Can you speak a bit on that topic?
Yeah, I mean, I sort of locked my way in my office for about 2 weekends to try to get my head around this, because it is complicated. Mm. I found out I was gluten intolerant, not celiacs, a few years ago, and switching off processed bread, eating sourdough bread. I can now enjoy sourdough bread nicely. But then I noticed, and other people have noticed, that, you know, they were getting the same symptoms of bloating and tiredness if they weren't eating gluten, but they were eating like oats, which doesn't have gluten in. And oats has, you know, like other grains and pulses, as we've just mentioned, has lectins and phytic acid, which actually people don't tend to talk about, but you get the same intolerance to those as well. And then you've got the paleo enthusiasts who and there's a place called Tarifa in Spain, which I love. I go windsurfing and kitesurfing there. And there's a friend of mine there called Rowan, who's an enormous paleo enthusiast. So he's banned anything grains from his diet. And it's true, you know, if you have an intolerance, it does give you a lift. But these foods, especially the grains, they actually contain, prebiotics, which help gut health. And the FODMAP people are saying, well, we shouldn't be having beans because it will cause gas. And I've figured it out, I think. Basically, if you have lots of beans and they're not used to them, and there's data to support, it's not just my opinion, you do get wind, you do get bloating. So you instantly feel bad. If you've got a gut which is leaky, it's been exposed to gluten and phytic acid for years, so it's thin, it gets very sensitive. You only have to take one tiny bit of bread and suddenly you bloat up again. Mm. But if you allow the gut to heal, so if you eat these beans and you eat lots of healthy, bacteria-rich foods, eventually your gut starts healing. And you don't then get the gas and the bloating when you take the beans. So what the FODMAP is doing is giving you an instant relief because you're not getting the wind and the bloating. But in the long term, my opinion is it's actually making it worse. So I don't know why there's such an enthusiasm for it. And the same with grains. As long as you're not, as long as you've got good gut health otherwise, introducing some grains and beans will actually in the long term improve your gut health. So that's my take on it, that, don't be a paleo enthusiast and don't be a FODMAP enthusiast in the long term.
In the long term, exactly. Yeah. And I'm glad we're talking about this, because it's something I get asked about a lot. And I always pre-warn people that if they're going to start, eating chickpeas and beans and, whole grains, and their starting point from the start line is a quite processed, refined diet, you've got to go slow.
Yeah.
Because you're going to know about it and everyone else is going to know about it as well in your vicinity. So you have to go very slow when starting a new diet, any new diet really, yeah, or a new way of eating. And otherwise you'll fall into that camp and you'll be led by certain advocates of different diets and say, well, you had these symptoms. If you take them away, this gets better. Ergo, you should follow this way for the rest of your life. And, we're all on a continuum when it comes to
it does work. If you say to someone who's not used to beans and they've been taking beans and getting bloated, and someone comes along and says, go on to the FODMAP, you're going to feel better a week later, but you're not going to feel better 6 months later.
Yeah. Let's talk about, you tackled some really heavy, we're not going to get a chance to go through everything, obviously, but fat, cholesterol, dairy, eggs, you talk about a lot of this stuff in the book. I want to specifically hone down on milk and cancer. I'm sure you get asked about this a lot in clinic. We have discussed this briefly before. What are your thoughts on milk and cancer?
It's a tricky one, because there's not, there's no randomized data giving half the population milk and half not. You know, in the sort of 80s, there was this thing that, you know, because the Asia don't drink milk and they have less cancer, milk is therefore harmful. So it's not really statistically valid. If you, as we get older, we do tend to get more lactose intolerant. So milk will cause a sort of bit of an inflammation in your gut, which is not a good thing. We do know that milk has, you know, has hormones. The cows are injected with hormones. They've got insulin-like growth factors, which are a bit concerning. You know, they can drive cancer cells, etc. We also know that, you know, milk can be fattening. It's got cholesterol. So if you're struggling with your weight or cholesterol, probably not a good idea. And if you're overweight, you're more likely to get cancer. Mm-hmm. But, you know, putting it into the category of a toxin is definitely the other, is too extreme. I mean, having a little bit of milk in your tea and coffee, having a cortado or a coffee with a small amount of milk rather than a massive latte, you see sometimes like a pint of coffee. And also, if you actually look at the large cohort studies about milk, if you look at the data carefully, that if you take out cheese from the evaluation, which is generally beneficial, it was really just the whole milk seemed to be the thing which is edging on, you know, especially if you have too much, on the harm. Because in fact, there was one study which showed if you excluded ice cream, for some reason ice cream was not harmful. But anyway, I won't go there. but certainly, if you process cheese, especially cheese which has been matured or fermented, there's vitamin K2, the lactose has been broken down. As long as you don't eat too many, they tend to be beneficial. So I actually encourage people to take a little bit of cheese, which tastes nice as well. You know, as good for bone health, and it doesn't, the evidence isn't strong at all that it causes cancer or risk of other disease in moderation.
Yeah, so I suppose it goes down to those things that we were talking about earlier about how the food is produced, what you're eating it with, and what the rest of your diet looks like as well. I mean, I always talk to people about milk and cancer and you know, saying that basically it has mixed results and you know, there's no one way either way. But I certainly wouldn't advise having like gallons of it like you just described there. And, you know, there are lots of different alternatives for people who don't want to consume milk for whatever the reason might be, which are fortified with B12, iodine, and calcium too. Estrogenic effect. You mentioned xenoestrogens before, and estrogen. I wonder if we can clarify where we tend to get xenoestrogens in the diet or the atmosphere, and what impact that might have.
Phytoestrogens are estrogens within food, like soya beans, chickpeas, and most studies show they're beneficial. You know, I mean, and there's been some large studies. Xenoestrogens are chemicals which are usually man-made, which are estrogenic, and they act on the estrogen receptor very different to the phytoestrogens. The phytoestrogens tend to sit on the estrogen receptor and actually reduce estrogen. It's called down signaling. So effectively, they're reducing the impact of estrogen in your body. Xenoestrogens sit on the estrogen receptor and literally switch it on. So the effect of estrogen in your body will dramatically increase. And these are things like car fumes, pesticides, herbicides, aluminium, parabens. And that's why, and plastics, you know, and that's that's why, you know, people are saying I'm being charged 10p for a plastic bag in Tesco. That's why, because these plastic bags and lots of other things are going into the general population, into the environment, and slowly estrogenizing all of us, but in a bad way. You know, it's the estrogens which really trigger the estrogen receptor and tell the estrogen receptor to do its harm.
And on that note, you mentioned pesticides there. Is that an argument for organic food? I mean, I know it might not be practical. I mean, neither of us are farmers here, but, you know, if we were to design an agricultural system that removed pesticides, herbicides, and all the other potential toxic effects, would that be something that we should be looking at?
I think so. I mean, as you know, from the chapter in the book, there's lots of other benefits for the environment of growing organically, like having natural hedgerows with more insects and blah, blah, less soil erosion and all those other things. But purely on a health basis, there's not many trials or randomized trials which show organic food actually produces less illness than standard foods. There's a couple which I've listed. There's certainly evidence that if you eat organically, you're more likely, you get more polyphenols, vitamins and essential nutrients in your body. So they tend to be healthier foods the way they're grown. And they certainly have less potential toxins. They have, you know, less pesticides, herbicides. So it's just hard to prove that. You know, you need these trials would have to be over a 10-year period in thousands of people to show any statistical benefit. But the common sense point of view is, yes, if you can introduce as much organic as you can, and there's other ways you can wash your vegetable. I mean, leafy, you know, paradoxically, something like salad or lettuce actually has a big surface area. So it's actually got quite a lot of toxins on it. So just get into the habit of washing everything. And if you had a choice, you know, buying organic, but I don't believe you need to completely go that way.
Yeah. Exactly. I always say whenever I get asked this question, my primary focus is to get more plants on people's plates, and the secondary objective is, you know, to go organic where possible. But I mean, I live in London. I'm right next to a road. I think I've got bigger things that are probably increasing my toxic load than the food. Although everything is cumulative, I guess. So, you know, I try and make a concerted effort if I can.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. I mean, you know, you're in the sort of basin of London, you're going to be exposed, you know, daily. And obviously, if you go jogging, I would recommend you go into the park. There was a study comparing jogging down Oxford Street compared to Hyde Park. So,
I remember that.
Which I quite like. So you can, you know, limit it a bit to make sure you're around trees and things. I recently bought a little device. I'm probably showing my paranoia here, which you can measure the amount of toxins in the air. And it's actually, you still get more in your house than outdoors. So actually keeping a window open in the day, you know, it's just practical things like that can help.
I'm going to have to get that device. I'm just fascinated to know what the state of my household is.
Well, you can have mine, because what you get paranoid for the first year and then you ignore it completely. And they're quite expensive. But it is quite, you know, it does show quite clearly, you know, if you're using household, you know, furniture polish or dishwasher fluid, you know, you see a peak in these things which we're breathing. Whereas if you have you know, a clean house, get rid of the dust, keep the windows open, it does reduce it. So there's lots of little things you can do, but it's very hard to prove really if that's going to stop your risk of, you know, dementia 20 years later. It's just about trying your best in all parts of your life, you know, what you eat.
Just changing a few things, you know, if you could categorize them according to your washing up, your beauty, hygiene, you know, keeping plants, and you've got a beautiful list of plants to keep in your bedroom and stuff as well. So, you know, there are a few things that you can do.
Yeah, exactly.
Eggs. So eggs have gone up and down in favor depending on who you speak to. I've had a number of different opinions on the podcast in the past, so you know, I like to get opinions from everyone, whether they be vegan researchers or doctors or people who are of a different persuasion or low carb, whatever. So considering the amount of work you've done for the book as well, what is your perspective on eggs and whether they're something to keep in the diet or something that we should radically remove in the same way we would remove a carcinogen?
Again, I like you, I was confused with it, and that's why I think I've done half a chapter on eggs, because I mean, having designed or looked at very large cohort data, we've recently published one looking at tea, for example, showing it was beneficial, but it's incredibly complicated to analyze these large data sets. And a lot of them, the last three I've noticed with eggs, I've grouped eggs together with meat. So, and the headline comes out as eggs are harmful. But if you actually read it, you say, no, they didn't look at eggs on their own. They looked at eggs, dairy and meat as an entity. And there was only the journalist or the way it was emphasized, they said. And anyway, so then that sort of prompted me to think, well, the data isn't strong anyway. but there was, for example, it was a study saying more than one egg a day increased your risk of prostate cancer. But again, that was linked with meat. But even if that was true, then you look to see what is it in eggs which could be harmful. Well, the yolk is a little bit fattening. So if you're overweight, you know, I see patients from all parts of their cancer process, including some, unfortunately, who are quite ill and losing weight. And we know that having low proteins in your bloodstream is very bad. So egg whites, for example, is an excellent source of protein. So I'd strongly say, look, if you don't want to eat the yellow, at least eat the egg whites. But the bottom line is there are chemicals in eggs which are pro-inflammatory. They can increase gut inflammation, which, as you know, and we've talked about, is a bad thing. It causes leaky gut and all sorts of things. But if you eat an egg with foods which are anti-inflammatory, and the trials support this, that if you look at the patients, if you do the subpopulation in an analysis where they've eaten eggs, but eaten lots of spinach and other things, there's no increased risk from them. In fact, there's a benefit. So it's the same thing we've all been talking about. If you're going to have eggs for breakfast, don't have it with bacon, sausages, black pudding, white pudding. You have it with, you know, wilted spinach, a little bit of sprinkled pomegranate, mushrooms, tomatoes, coriander. And then you get the benefit of the eggs, and any slight risk associated will completely be overtaken by the other things. So it's all about combining the eggs with other things. But yeah, that's I think, the solution.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, because dietary studies are so hard to do, we tend to look at things in a singular way, whether it be an egg or, you know, a particular supplement or, you know, one type of food. Whereas that's not how we eat. We eat food, we eat plates of food, we eat combinations of food. And I think it's that synergy, which is really hard to study, that often gets forgotten with these things. So yes, if you look at egg, you can describe it as high in choline and B12 and, you know, bits of vitamin D and good protein, and there's some inflammatory elements as well. However, when you combine it as part of that plate that you just described, you get the benefits and you mitigate any potential risks.
Absolutely, well put.
Yeah, great. Well, I'm glad we got to that. And, you know, whether you choose to eat eggs or not, it's up to you. No one here is saying you have to eat eggs, but I think similarly, you shouldn't be put off eggs because of some of those headlines. One for the vegans and for one for people who eat 100% plant-based is plant protein and bone health. There are some benefits to be associated with plant proteins, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, in terms of, you know, osteoporosis and osteopenia is very common in the UK. Vitamin D deficiency is common. And certainly after cancer, you're more likely to get osteoporosis. And, you know, strangely, people say, well, I'll have a steak to improve my bone health. It doesn't. It's in fact, it probably harms it a little bit. So yeah, plant there's loads of epic studies. I can quote you 10 studies all show that the more plant proteins you eat, soya, chickpeas, beans, they're the things which protect your bones. Gut health is one of the biggest factors for protecting your bones as well. So so the vegans, one up for the vegans on that side. You know, the only thing about vegan is the B12 is the biggest concern. And I was doing some research, I was reading other people's research on how to increase your B12 if you don't eat meat. And, you know, obviously seaweed does have some B12 as well as iodine, which we also need to increase in our diets. Otherwise, we'll all get goiters like we did in the 2 centuries ago. You've just got to be careful with the seaweed foods that it is, and the spirulina and all those things, that they are, they're wild. If you put them into these big vats and just feed them sort of nutrients, you think you're getting something healthy, but they don't actually produce B12 in that way. It has to be sort of wild seaweed and wild.
I
can't remember the name of the algae, wild algae, that's the one.
Do they bioaccumulate as well in terms of toxins in the sea, or is that just fish?
That's the negative. And people, I've had those questions saying, well, you're telling me to eat seaweed. I mean, I'm from South Wales, and we used to love lava bread. I have to say, I wouldn't touch any lava bread from the Bristol Channel anymore. seeing the colour of the water. So yeah, you, it is true. There was. I read one study about, you know, they are. It's mainly on the surface. So if you wash them, you do significantly reduce the number of pollutants which are in them. It's not absorbed into the plant as much. So it's really important to wash your seaweed. And, you know, try to get them from you know, better sources, I suppose. Yeah. And I'm not really skilled on knowing where they're from, but certainly, you know, the Atlantic and the western coast of Brittany and places like that, that's where the lava bread, for example, which is a seaweed, comes from now. And I would trust that better.
On the subject of the environment, you know, we had a lot of scaremongering around radiation towards the start of the pandemic and whether, you know, the coronavirus is related to mobile stands and all that kind of stuff. Are there any concerns with regards to EMF and radiation and overall health? And are there things that we should be doing pragmatically to reduce any potential risks?
Yeah, I mean, I've been looking a lot at that, and you know, through oncology for 30 years, that's coming up regularly in terms of whether it's a cancer risk. The data is pretty poor, to be honest. There was some very high frequency masks, you know, actually in Italy, where they did show a link between certain leukemias if you live very close to them. You know, obviously the mobile phone issue, whether you're more likely to have a brain cancer. You know, there's, to be honest, nothing's been established, to be honest. It doesn't really produce radiation, it's more radio frequency. You know, they have found brain damage, you know, heat damage, in fact, if people use the phone a lot. So it does make sense to use, you know, to use headphones when you can. But it's not really been established, to be honest. I'm not saying it's, it, you know, it will never be established, but at the moment, there's not strong evidence. There's anecdotal reports. There's some women who put their phone in their bra. It's not an uncommon habit. And there's some cases where women have had breast cancer underneath where they normally put their phone. So perhaps I wouldn't recommend that. And they say men shouldn't stick it down the front of their trousers. It's all anecdotal. But it sort of makes sense, really, doesn't it? Just to sort of keep it away from your body a bit.
Yeah, yeah. I think I echo that, that there isn't anything that I can say hand on heart that is proving a link. But, you know, if it makes you feel better for whatever reason to put your phone somewhere else, then, you know, that's fine until we know a bit more.
Yeah.
The last thing I want to ask you about, because there's so many things I could ask you about in this book, but that I was really interested to know in the benefits of exercise, as you always talk about, but how nutrition could even enhance the effect of exercise as well, and if there are combinative effects or synergistic effects or maybe even exponential impacts.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of time, it depends why you're exercising, obviously. If you're exercising to lose weight, well, we should all exercise for lots of reasons. But say if your primary emphasis is to lose weight, I always say, you know, exercise on an empty stomach. Exercise first thing in the morning or before your lunch, or preferably both, because your body then looks for the energy not in what's in your stomach, it's in your fat reserve. So it's reversing the energy storage mechanism. If you're not used to exercising or you want to sort of improve your times and you're pushing yourself a little bit, you have to be worried about increasing free radicals. And I think, you know, making sure you have plenty of polyphenols and nitrate rich foods such as you said, pomegranate, grapes, broccoli, you know, take your pick. I think it's good. Cherries. It's a good idea to make sure you really, on the day you're exercising, you really load yourself with those. And you will see a benefit as well. I mean, it's not only reducing the free radical, it actually helps with the joint health. So a lot of athletes have to stop because they've pulled a muscle or they've damaged a joint, and it protects you against that. It's not just about the exercising. You need to sort of think what you're doing at the same time.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And I think, you know, to that point about a high polyphenol-rich diet, it's going to improve your gut health. It's going to improve weight control. In fact, I think you've spoken about weight control in the book as well, and You know, how it's not just about calorie restriction or energy restriction. It's about introducing things like spices and herbs and even some novel fruits as well.
Yeah, yeah.
Brilliant. Well, Prof, this has been fantastic. I highly recommend people get the book.
Thank you very much.
I'll be shouting about it for the rest of the year as well, because I think it's just a fantastic manual, and the way it's spaced out as well with paragraphs as well. It's not, you can just dive into it and dive out as well. If you have a question or you read a headline, you can go back into reading the book and stuff. And I hope you'll update it as well every few years or so.
Yeah, I hope so. It's a different, you know, some people read it from front to back, and then you'll find there's some sections which might have repeated themselves a little bit. But we also want the chapters to be sort of standalone. So you have to repeat it. So if you want to just read about gut health or, you know, how to improve my exercise performance, hopefully you can dip in and just use it as a bit of a reference guide as well. So it was a nice experience to write it. You know, financially, as you know, it's not a big situation. You probably get paid, you know, less than the cleaner in the hospital by far. But it's a satisfying experience, and it's a way of processing your thoughts so that if you know you can just understand the issues better. So it's really nice to have your comments and comments from other readers, which we're getting most days. So it's thanks for your support.
Definitely, of course. I can't wait to continue to support it. Thank you so much, Robert. Honestly, it's been brilliant. Thank you so much for listening to today's pod. I really do hope you get a copy of How to Live. It is a fantastic resource. I'm diving into it every now and then as well, just when I need to refresh something or check up a reference. And I really hope it's going to be one of those books that gets new editions every few years or so, just to keep it fresh, because it's a brilliant piece of work and I cannot recommend it enough. Thank you so much for listening to the pod today, and I will see you next week.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High-quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.